We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn, sitting in for David Inge. Today, we'll look at how cities across the U.S. are sparking economic development by being green. Here's one example. The city of Chicago is working to meet its waste reduction goals by helping businesses become more profitable. How? By pairing the waste collection costs borne by those businesses while simultaneously reducing supply costs for business. Put simply, garbage becomes gold by going green. Our guest this morning is urban planner Joan Fitzgerald. She is the author of Emerald Cities, Urban Sustainability and Economic Development. In her book, Joan Fitzgerald explores five economic sectors and their economic and environmental connections. They are renewable energy, energy efficiency, green buildings, waste management, and transportation. Listeners, I look forward to your questions and comments. Join us with a phone call or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Joan Fitzgerald, our guest, is professor and director of the Law, Policy, and Society Program at Northeastern University. Her book, Emerald Cities, is published by Oxford. And she is joining us this afternoon from Chicago, where later today, April 8th, 2010, she'll be giving a talk in Chicago. Professor Fitzgerald, where will you be?
I will be at the University Center at 525 South State Street.
Okay, very good. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
The first city you write about in Emerald Cities is a city in Germany, Freiburg. Would you describe Freiburg for our listeners?
Sure. Freiburg is probably one of the greenest cities I've ever been to. And they decided early in the 80s that they were going to be a solar city. Part of it was because there was going to be a nuclear power plant built there. They decided they didn't want that and realized, well, if they didn't want that, they'd have to come up with an alternative. Along with that, they developed a number of policies to promote not only renewable energy but green living. So they got rid of all cars in their immediate downtown, what's called the Old Town. And so there are lots of trolley lines that run through and lots of bikers. This is true of many northern European cities, but in particular in Freiburg. It's a university town, so the idea of biking goes well with the population as well. In addition to that, they've developed a whole new area of the city in what we would call transit-oriented development. And what they did was make this community completely green. 95% of its energy comes from on-site renewable energy. They use natural sewer, or not sewer systems, but they use natural systems so that rainwater doesn't go through the sewer system and is absorbed naturally in the land. But the thing about Freiburg that actually became the impetus for the book was the way that they promoted solar energy and other renewable energy by putting policies in place that increased demand. So one of those is something called a feed-in tariff, where they subsidize the rate for renewable energy, but also put solar panels everywhere. There were probably over 1,000 installations on most all public buildings, stadiums, railway stations, schools, in order to create demand. And what's interesting about that, and that's where the idea for this book came from, Freiburg, the policies that Aachen, Freiburg, and other German cities implemented to leapfrog the development of solar and wind and other renewable energies was replicated by the German federal government. They looked around, saw what the cities were doing, how effective it was, and using those policies, Germany for many years remained the dominant exporter of solar and wind technology. And so my idea was to go back to the United States and look at cities were doing and how they were making links to sustainability and economic development.
One of your guides in the city in Freiburg linked sustainability directly with the city's growth. How? And did they know that that would be the result of what all these activities would be when they started?
I don't think they knew exactly how it would go when they started. What they wanted to do was make the city more energy efficient and to use more renewable energy. I think then as the planning community, as they realized, well, there had to be a strong connection with transportation then. And so one of the things in this community that I was talking about, it's called Vauban, that they did was they built out the trolley system to go to this neighborhood. But then they used carrots and sticks, as I tell my students. So the carrot is building out the trolley line, giving everyone who lives there a free pass to use it. But if you cannot park your car in the neighborhood. If you want to park your car, you have to buy a very expensive parking space in a parking garage outside of the neighborhood. And so that's the stick. So they used both in order to get people out of their cars, on their bikes, on the trolley. And so I think things built upon each other. One thing that happened then, when they started creating demand, solar companies started locating there. And then when there was a decision about where to locate Germany's largest solar renewable energy research institute, Freiburg became the logical place. And then that, in turn, spawned more company development, more research and cooperation with companies. So I think the vision was somewhat there, but then it just kept building as the planning process was put in place.
How long a process has this been?
Well, it depends on where you want to start. Mm. I mean, the proposal for the nuclear plant was actually in 1974. The Solar Freiburg, the vision of that was in 1986. So they've been at it for quite a long time. And similarly, if we look at Germany and solar energy or renewable energy, their first national feed-in tariff was started in 1991.
We like carrots. We're not at all fond of sticks. So was there a ruckus about the sticks?
Not so much, because people would choose whether to live in this neighborhood. I mean, this wasn't something universally applied throughout the city. Then there no doubt would be a ruckus. But people would choose to live there. Let me point to another example of a very similar kind of development in Stockholm, Sweden, called Hammarby Sjöstad. Very similar. They took a huge brownfield area of the city and redeveloped it as an eco-community. And they built it out in stages. And the stick in this, in order, they did the same thing. They built a trolley line to connect to the subway. And they tried to minimize, they had car sharing clubs, tried to minimize car use. One way that you can minimize car use is to limit the number of parking spaces. And when they started it, it was half a parking space per unit of development. And they had to change that, because people said this was just too hard to manage and they needed cars. So then they changed it. They increased it, but it's still considerably less than any city in the United States in terms of the amount of parking.
Hmm. This is Focus. I'm Celeste Quinn sitting in today for David Inge. This morning we're taking a look at how cities across the U.S. are sparking economic development by being green. And so far we've talked mostly about some cities in Germany and in Sweden, but we will get to the United States shortly. Our guest this morning is urban planner Joan Fitzgerald. She is the author of Emerald Cities, Urban Sustainability and Economic Development. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you this morning to join us with a telephone call or by email with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's take a call now from a listener in St. Charles in northern Illinois. Line 4, good afternoon.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm sorry.
Oh, it's okay. I know for you it's kind of early, Celeste. I want to say I'm a builder, and I do a lot of traveling around, but it's kind of difficult to go green in a lot of these towns. And the reason I say that is because a lot of these existing buildings, especially in the older towns, aren't fit for putting solar panels on. I mean, you could probably change out light bulbs and, you know, light fixtures and things like that, but it's still costly. And then the other thing comes up to mind is the codes. And, you know, I've been into business for 20-some-odd years, and I kind of aim at, you know, all the building that should be going on now from here on out should be all green. There should be, you know, the lighting system should be what we should by code have. You know, if you can incorporate solar panels and wind generation, another one, which would be nice, but it's extremely expensive. And I would love myself if I could do solar and wind, and it'd be save me a lot of money. But unfortunately, because of where I'm at, you can't by code do anything like that. They're very picky, unless you live out in the rural area somewhere. And I've been to Germany. I spent months there in the summer, actually learning a trade and building, and enjoyed every minute of it, but their whole infrastructure in Germany is totally different than ours, so it's kind of hard to compare the two. Most people don't drive. You know, everything is centrally located. You know, small towns have their own, you know, most people use bicycles, or like you said, the train or the trolley, which is a good thing. But, you know, how do you take, say, a town that's 150, 200 years old and try to convert every building on the block into, you know, green outside of changing light bulbs? And you know, it's kind of difficult. And plus, changing people's habits.
Yeah, I'm gonna jump in here because we got some really good topics on the table, and I know our guest is going to be happy to address your questions and your comments. Joan Fitzgerald?
Yes, there are a lot of questions there. I'll try to remember all of them. Let me start by saying when we say going green with buildings, I think it's important to point out that the first thing you should do is not think about renewable energy. The first thing you should do is to make it as efficient as possible. And so we see a lot of cities throughout the country have initiatives using their stimulus funds for this purpose. And you're right, it has to go on beyond changing light bulbs. It has to go with more efficient heating and cooling systems, more efficient lighting, more efficient appliances, insulation, windows. Those are the things that are going to give you the biggest bang for the buck. Then, you know, retrofitting. It is for renewable energy. But a lot of the renewable energy is going on new buildings. So the first priority for cities absolutely should be retrofitting existing buildings to make them more efficient. Chicago, for example, has a wonderful program in place putting a lot of funds into retrofitting city buildings, but also having programs where residents and businesses can also make their buildings more efficient. And we're seeing more and more of these kind of programs. I think the caller makes another very important point, that this has to happen in the energy codes. A lot of cities point to the fact that they have LEED buildings or are following some standard. City may have its own standard for green buildings. For the most part, that covers just new construction, which is a very small part of the infrastructure of any city. But if you put it in the building codes, the energy codes, then it will affect any remodeling, any retrofitting that's done. And so that should be done. One of the things that I found out in doing this is that some cities, by statute, cannot make their energy efficiency code, their building code, stricter than that of the state. So it's really up to the state. And there is a provision for receiving additional funds in the stimulus that cities have to change, or states, their building code to be a stricter code. In terms of the comparisons of Germany or in any European country in the United States, yes, cities do tend to be dense and have public transportation infrastructures, but so do many cities in the United States, are larger cities. And there are cities such as Portland, Oregon, that have used transit-oriented development to really revitalize areas of the city and build that infrastructure where it didn't exist before. They used a streetcar system that has extremely high ridership. Los Angeles is developing a public transportation system. And for those cities that don't have the density for the kind of public transportation the caller sees in Europe, bus systems can be put in place. That's a little tougher. It's hard to get Americans into buses. So granted, in the less dense cities, public transportation is difficult.
And I think one other issue he raised was culture.
Mm-hmm.
Germans are different than Americans. Americans, maybe we're less likely to go along with somebody telling us we need to do this.
Well, we like our cars, and
yep, there you go. Perfect.
You know, an exercise I do with my students is ask how many take public transportation. You know, and I get a show of hands, and then I ask how many could take public transportation and don't. And that's always a bigger show of hands. And, you know, then when you ask why, it's always the convenience. It's there when I want it. I have stops to make along the way. And so it really does, you know, going back to what I said in the beginning, there have to be carrots and sticks in place. And I think the cities that are building transit-oriented neighborhoods, Denver is another good case, finding that people really do like to live in denser neighborhoods, and as long as they can walk or easily get to the commercial activities and other activities they need to. But so we have to make it very attractive.
This is Focus. Our guest today, urban planner Joan Fitzgerald. She's professor and director of the Law, Policy, and Society Program at Northeastern University. She is the author most recently of Emerald Cities, Urban Sustainability, and Economic Development. Listeners, if you'd like to join us this morning on Focus, give us a call, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. You may also join us by email. That address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Early in the book, you note that strategies for green development can help alleviate poverty and improve our overall quality of life. How?
Well, let me give you an example of how those goals are linked in Los Angeles. Los Angeles just put in place a very ambitious energy efficiency program, and they're going to be going into buildings all over the city and retrofitting them for efficiency. They have started out, the priority is going to be low-income neighborhoods. And then, working with their community college system, they've developed training programs, and with their unions have reserved slots for people in those neighborhoods to get training in the various fields associated with energy efficiency. So that could be heating and cooling, construction, and related industries. So it's an investment. It will free up money that people normally were paying on high utility bills to spend elsewhere in the city, create jobs, and create jobs for people in low-income neighborhoods. So that's one real example of how those goals can all be interconnected.
Yeah. How can economically depressed cities develop practices that will improve their situations?
Well, that was one of the most interesting parts of the book for me, in that my assumption in the beginning was that I would look to the cities that are doing the most in terms of sustainability, climate change, and then look how they were connecting it. And what I was finding was that some of the cities that certainly weren't on any of the top 10 green cities list, that couldn't really afford to think about bike trails and parks and green roofs and that sort of thing, but had high unemployment rates, were the ones that were perhaps first to think about, okay, how can we cash in on this green trend? And one of those cities is Toledo, Ohio, which is moving forward in solar production. And part of this is because the University of Toledo has a long-standing research program in solar energy, but that came out of their auto glass industry. And it was some of the same researchers, you know, in terms of thin film as it is applied to auto glass, applying it to solar. And so this was transformational in taking an existing sector and transforming it. Another one is Cleveland, Ohio. And, you know, it's another old manufacturing city and high unemployment. They're looking at developing wind energy off of the lake. And they're at this point testing, and they found that the resource is very high. And they're working with a company now to put up some turbines, see how they do, because it's a very different thing to put a wind turbine in a lake than it is to put it in an offshore situation. And they're investing in a research program at Case Western Reserve University and then looking into the possibility of actually producing those turbines in the area.
It's very interesting to run across Toledo in the book, and it's going into this direction in solar and how and where that came from. And if anybody ever visits Toledo, Ohio in the near future, I would recommend that you visit there. They have a beautiful museum of glass. It's really something. So it's very interesting to see cities look at where they are, what they have, and how they can move forward.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about Milwaukee. Here's another Middle Western city. Milwaukee's program to retrofit existing buildings to become more energy efficient.
Yeah, this is a partnership with the city and a research, kind of a think and do tank there called the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. Its acronym is COWS. And they and a number of other cities across the country are trying to address this problem that our caller put in that if you want to invest in renewable energy, you want to invest in retrofitting your house to make it more efficient, you know that that's going to pay off in the future, but you still have to come up with the money now, and that's hard for people to do. So they're trying to overcome that hurdle by setting up a fund and attaching, different cities are doing it in different ways, that you pay it back out of the savings of your utility bill. So on your utility bill. So for example, if your utility, you know, your heating used to be $300 a month, and because of the retrofits you made, it's $150 a month, you still will for a certain period pay that $300 a month, and the $150 will be the payment on everything that you've invested in. And different cities are doing it different ways. Some are putting it on a property tax bill, some on a utility bill. Different states have regulations that prevent it from being on one or the other. So what cities are doing right now is figuring out, you know, where that payment will be and getting the initial funding in place so that you can have a revolving loan fund and make it feasible for people to make that investment. Now, one of the programs I talked about, Berkeley First, was doing this kind of thing for solar installations, and unfortunately the program was recently stopped because they didn't get the startup capital that they needed. But it was an interesting idea of putting the funding on the property tax, and it stays with the tax or with the property. Because one of the things people, we're a highly mobile society, people don't know, am I going to be living here in 10 years? I don't want to make that investment if it's not going to pay off. And this stays with the property so that you eliminate that disincentive.
So there are initiatives that don't achieve the goals that were set or don't turn out as planned.
Oh, yeah. Many.
Yeah. Okay.
But, you know, I think there again, you know, one of the first questions you asked me was how long Germany or how long Freiburg had been at this. We're just starting on this. So there's going to be a period of trial and error where you try different things, and that's a good thing. You know, you experiment, and then other cities share that information so you see what works and what doesn't and why, and also what will work in different places is going to differ.
How significant have the energy tax credits been in terms of encouraging upgrading for energy efficiency?
Energy tax, federal energy tax credits?
Yes.
You know, I don't know. My focus has basically been on what kind of tax credits are at the local and state level.
At the local and state level, are there initiatives that have gotten the attention of the federal government as what happened in Germany?
Well, sure. If you look at, for example, states that have renewable portfolio standards, and that is the state establishes that by a certain year, utilities have to buy a certain percentage of their electricity from renewable sources. Now, states vary tremendously in specifying those renewable sources, in what those percentages are, and over how long a time period. That was a policy that was also used in Germany. A few cities actually have portfolio standards, and the energy bill that's been proposed at the federal level has a portfolio standard in that. So there is an example where a policy started out at the local and predominantly at the state level, and if the energy bill passes, we will have a national portfolio standard as well.
Which U.S. states and cities are leading the way?
Well, the city I'm in right now, Chicago, I think is a leader. Chicago's climate action plan, I think, is one of the best in the country, in that in its comprehensiveness and its focus is on first on energy efficiency, which is exactly where it should be, but then also on renewable energy, and it covers just the whole range of activities that are needed. A city that always surprises people when I say this, that I think is really moving in the right direction, is Los Angeles, and people say, well, gee, Los Angeles, you always think of smog and traffic, and that's true. But when we look at cities like Boston, where I live, or New York, they're very dense cities. By virtue of that, they're going to be more efficient. They have long-standing public transportation with lots of stops where people need to be. So in a way, they start out on third base, and they don't have to do too much to look really good. when you start out as Los Angeles with the kind of sprawl that they have and are making enormous investments in building out public transportation, enormous investments in building efficiency and green building, and also as an economic development strategy, really promoting clean tech industries locating in Los Angeles. Los Angeles also has one of the highest recycling rates in the country. It's approaching 70%. That's one that's been really tough for a lot of cities, California cities in general, because it's mandated by the state. So in a number of ways, you've got leadership both in Chicago and in Los Angeles, you know, from the mayor that is infiltrated down into community organizations, where it's on the agenda of a lot of different players and stakeholders.
When I introduced you on the topic this morning, I mentioned Chicago's waste reduction program, and you write about it in a chapter called Is There Treasure in Our Trash? Tell us a little something about Chicago's program.
Right. Chicago is called the Waste to Profit Network, and this is also something that we followed from the UK. There was a very large program throughout the country on this. And the basic idea is you get a group of businesses together and start talking about their production processes, what their outputs are, what their inputs are. And you find that there's a lot of ways that a lot of synergies. And so one of the ones that's so interesting in Chicago, there was a company that it produces heat-treated glass, and that can't be recycled because of the heat, the coating or whatever that's on it, because it's heat-treated. And it's very heavy and costly to get rid of. And another business, it was actually a business startup, started, and what it does is use that glass as an input into countertops and tiles. So this company gets to eliminate its cost of getting rid of the glass. The other company gets a free input to its product, and it's making a recycled. It's made of an almost completely recycled product. There are lots of examples of these synergies that were created through this. I think in the first year they had something like 100 businesses participating and finding it worth their while and creating synergies. There's a company that makes sound barriers and bumpers for parking lots out of completely recycled plastic that it's taking from other businesses. And that strategy is catching on, but catching on slowly. In the Seattle area, they're building one of these. Ohio is trying to do it at the state level. Again, a lot of this stuff is about going to scale, moving it from small scale to a much larger scale where you can get synergies and reduce a lot of cost in waste management for businesses, which makes it profitable for them, but also reduce the input costs for businesses that are using those products.
Why is this catching on slowly?
That's a good question. I think part of the reason is we tend as a nation not to like to do national planning. And how it caught on in the U.S. is the EU decided that each member country had to reduce the amount of waste it sends to landfills by a certain percentage of over a period of time. And every country could do it as they wanted. And what they did in England was impose a tax on landfills. They used the money from that tax to develop this it's called the National Industrial Symbiosis Network. And then they just sprung up all over. There were 9 regions where they were managed, and you know, within a couple of years they were everywhere. Here it's someone gets the idea, takes it to a city, then you've got to find some kind of funding to get it started up, and it takes about 2 years total. And then you've got to spread the good news somewhere else. And someone, you know, then you find an organization or city government says, yeah, this is a good idea. We want to take it on. We don't do a lot of national or state-level planning that would allow things like this to move much faster.
Our guest this morning here on Focus, Joan Fitzgerald. She's an urban planner. She is professor and director of the Law, Policy, and Society program at Northeastern University in Boston. She's the author of Emerald Cities, Urban Sustainability and Economic Development. We're talking this morning about how cities across the U.S. are sparking economic development by being green, environmentally conscientious. My name is Celeste Quinn, sitting in today for David Inge. Listeners, you can join us this morning with a telephone call or by email. We welcome your questions and comments. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's take a call from a listener in Urbana. Hello, line one.
Hello. Seems to me I've heard that one of the biggest users of water is our toilets and wasting water, which of course costs money to treat and to pipe. And then if you pump the cold water into the tank and you have it sitting there, it absorbs heat from your house, so you have to reheat that air. Replacing toilets, there's no good way that I've heard of so far to recycle an old toilet. I mean, you can give it to Habitat, but then somebody else uses your old inefficient toilet. Have you come across any things that people are doing to massively recycle toilets?
Well, other than lawn ornaments, I don't know. You know, there is a recycling facility in Berkeley. And one of the things that I noticed in their yard where there were lots of toilets, but I think the problem you suggest, what they do is actually, if they don't sell them in a period of time, they do crush them and recycle them.
Well, we have a concrete recycling facility in town, but they don't take anything that's not concrete. Apparently it's hard on the blades, and they don't want stuff that's going to end up being sharp. Seems to me it could go into concrete countertops, but I don't know that concrete countertops are in. Well, the other thing that's happening in our area is that we have an aquifer, and we're drawing down the aquifer more and more each year. And the area that we are in is creating a big dip in the aquifer, so we're pulling water from other communities as well. And so there are multiple reasons to think about how do we deal with this problem? It's not only energy, it's also the fact that our water supply is being drawn down.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Water is an issue that I don't really talk about in the book, but it is certainly one that in a number of ways is going to be quite the issue. In terms of we use a lot of water because it's underpriced. We do not pay the full price for the water that we use. And what that means for cities, and this is the problem we're going to be hearing about again and again, is their infrastructure underneath the city that moves the water around is crumbling. There have been instances of large neighborhoods in Washington, D.C. and other cities that, due to infrastructure problems, just didn't have water. We also, because of the old infrastructure, lose a lot through seepage in the pipes before it ever gets to our tap, let alone the waste that we have there. So I think it'll be a very rude awakening as more and more cities need to replace that crumbling infrastructure and need to charge residents the real price of water. That will realize how much we use. I mean, one of the things that Mayor Daley used to do here whenever he gave a speech would tell everyone, don't leave the water running while you brush your teeth.
Hmm.
And, you know, when you've got a city of several million people and everyone stops doing that, that's a lot of water. But there are a number of measures, and that's part of the energy efficiency audit that happens, is looking at ways to reduce water consumption and ways that you don't even notice it.
Thanks
for the call. We're going to take another call from a listener in Urbana. This listener is on line two. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
I called a little bit earlier on, and then I had to take a break. I'm sorry if I missed something, but I wanted to point out the one caller that was talking about all we could do is change light bulbs. There's a lot you can do, especially on a builder's perspective, because that's also the trade that I'm in. You can use wood that other contractors are throwing out. You can reduce your off-gassing through, low VOC products instead of grabbing the cheap liquid nails that has benzene and toluene in it. You can get products that are completely green. Some of those are even coming out with the larger name brands, and you can buy them at some of the big box places. I've been doing this for quite a while, those types of things. basically when I would say, yeah, can I do a little bit of green building technique? And my client would go, what's that? And I would say, well, you know, we're going to, oh, well, as long as it doesn't cost more. I said, well, actually, I think it'll save money because, you know, I'm going to be using things that we can take out of your house and put back in. Instead of hauling up a 40-yard container and throwing everything out, from old tile to toilets and everything. Well, toilets probably something that needs to be replaced. But I hope that's been mentioned, and I really appreciate the program. And I'll take your comments off the air. Thanks so much.
Okay, thanks for your call. Thanks very much for that. No, we haven't talked about that.
Yeah, the caller is right in terms of there are so many things that can be done. And the actual cost, I think what the numbers show for new construction, is that building green may add 2-4%. But as building green becomes the standard, the extra cost actually goes down. But the payoff and the payoff period is very short on new construction and also in some kind of retrofits and rehabs as well. So it certainly, on economic grounds, can be argued. One other aspect of the book on this, I looked at programs in Pittsburgh and Syracuse, where working with the local universities, trying to create new green building products. And in Pittsburgh, trying to help building supply companies build green products. And so, for example, taking a company that made shades to make a type of shade that blocks sun better. In some, it's developing completely new products, new kinds of duct tape or new kinds of heating systems that clean the air better and are also more efficient. So there's a lot of research and development and new product development and manufacturing associated with the green building as well.
How significant a topic is what we're talking about today? That's urban sustainability and economic development. How significant a topic is this in the field of urban planning today?
I think it's very significant. This is what people are talking about. Cities are trying to developing climate change plans. It's almost a competition among cities about who can be greener. I mean, I watch it in my own city with Mayor Menino, and you know, keeping a close eye on everything that Chicago is doing. I think you're seeing it in the curriculum of planning programs as well, that it makes sense for cities because it saves them money. So that a lot of money that was spent on heating and cooling buildings inefficiently using big cars, or that's a big savings to cities. So it makes sense.
How significant a contribution can cities and states make in terms of dealing with climate change?
I don't think cities and states can do it on their own. This really requires a national commitment. And that's kind of one of the major conclusions of my book, and particularly if we want to make that economic development link. You've probably been reading articles in the New York Times and other papers showing that, well, first, Germany was the leader. Japan is a leader. China is taking over Japan, Germany, and others, as certainly in solar panels. They also want to be the leader in wind. There was an article in today's New York Times front page of the business section that China is such a leader in building high-speed rail that they want to come over here and do the building not only of the cars but of the whole rail systems in the United States. How these countries got to the point where they were was a significant national investment and a significant commitment to an industrial policy to build out what are going to be the high-tech industries of the future. And we're seeing some of that, certainly with the stimulus package, with the commitment to high-speed rail, Hopefully we'll see that in the transportation bill, much more money going into public transportation. But every one of these we can make a link to an economic development strategy. And going back to Germany, yes, there was a Green Party, but predominantly when this got to the federal level, they saw this as a way to reinforce their advanced manufacturing. And that's exactly what they did with it. And I think we really need to do that in this country. We can't rely. Cities can't create big enough markets to do it.
Mm. And one of the things we need so desperately are jobs. How many jobs could be created through green development projects if we made a significant investment?
Mm. That's a trick question. I have a whole section in the book on how hard that is.
I know. To answer.
I mean, we're talking a couple of million jobs built out. I mean, there's so many projections based on very different types of categorizing of what is a green job. So, you know, it's hard to tell. Let's just take the case of the wind industry, for example. So it's to produce a wind turbine has approximately 8,000 parts. So any given supplier is not just producing that part for the wind industry, but they're producing that part for other industries as well. So it's hard to decide how many green jobs does that create? But we could seriously have a couple of million green jobs. And probably more if you look at adding all of the associated energy efficiency. What I want to point out is that these aren't necessarily new jobs. These may be jobs that are already existing. And so maybe a company that already exists would expand because it's going into a new product line to serve, you know, some kind of clean technology. Right now what we're seeing in energy efficiency is people that were laid off or would have been laid off have work because of the stimulus money.
Hmm. Is organized labor looking at this as an opportunity?
Absolutely. Well, we see that in the Blue-Green Alliance, which is an alliance of the Sierra Club and the steelworkers. They have a conference coming up on green jobs. The Apollo Alliance, which is a coalition that includes labor, business, and organizations within cities. I mean, I think the labor movement has been very progressive in seeing the economic opportunity for putting people to work. So if we're going to build electric cars, if we're going to build the rail cars for high-speed rail, for expanding light rail or streetcar systems in cities, those are good union jobs. Similarly, if you look at much of the construction work in energy efficiency or installation of solar systems, those are creating good union jobs. So I see the unions very engaged on this issue.
Yeah. Are there opportunities for smaller communities? I'm thinking here in Illinois, we have a lot of counties that are largely rural. There's a county in our listening area that has a population around 10,000. At that level, are there things that can be learned from what their city cousins are doing?
Well, any size city can do energy efficiency. And there's funds available for that to make all of the buildings more efficient. So that's certainly a starting point. Obviously, public transportation is not going to be a factor there.
Mm-hmm.
But there's much they can do to make more efficient. Many rural areas are doing very well by leasing land for wind turbines and wind farms. But also many small towns have a manufacturing base, and the Midwest is growing wind turbine manufacturing facilities at a pretty rapid clip. And so to be a supplier to those industries is certainly part of it. I think looking at the supply chain for a number of clean technologies, it could help with rural areas that have a manufacturing base.
Mm. So we could have a bright and shining emerald landscape.
Perhaps.
It sure beats talking about the Rust Belt.
Right.
Well, there we will wrap it up. Joan Fitzgerald, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thanks again for having me.
And remind us again, you're going to be this afternoon at 3 o'clock, April 8th, 2010. You're going to be at the University Center in Chicago, which is at 525 South State Street. The public invited, and what's your topic?
The topic is the book.
Okay.
Emerald Cities, I'll be talking generally about the book and relating some of that to what's going on in Chicago.
Okay, very good. Joan Fitzgerald, she is professor and director of the Law, Policy, and Society program at Northeastern University. She is the author most recently of Emerald Cities, Urban Sustainability and Economic Development. The book is published by the Oxford University Press.